The Columbia Workshop.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight the Columbia Workshop dedicates the 18th program of its series to the scientists, research workers and engineers of the electrical industry, and especially to the New York Electrical Society, 1,100 of whose members are our guests here at the Columbia Radio Theater. In 1,000 laboratories throughout the land, constant investigation and effort goes on each day to harness more completely this silent, powerful force, electricity. Their contributions in the fields of communications, pathology, medicine, and transportation have done much to make the world a safer, healthier, more comfortable place in which to live. In previous workshop programs, we have attempted to familiarize you with some of their work in communications and pathology. Tonight, it seems appropriate that we deal with a phase of radio broadcasting that is unknown to most listeners. Dr. E.E. Freed, Columbia's scientific consultant and past president of the New York Electrical Society, is here with us. We believe you will be interested in his demonstration explaining how the Columbia Radio Theater, at one time completely unfit for broadcasting, was converted into one of the best auditorium studios in the country with the aid of the tools of science. Dr. Freed's demonstration will cover the first half of tonight's workshop program. For the second half, the Actors Repertory Company will help us demonstrate a new dramatic microphone technique by offering scenes from their new production, 200 Were Chosen by E.P. Conkle, which had its premiere on Broadway last night. The Columbia Workshop is glad to introduce Dr. E.E. Freed.
Thank you, Mr. Barry. The use of theaters for broadcasting purposes has become very popular in the past 2 years. Last year, more than 1 million persons witnessed about 1,500 broadcasts presented from the stages of the 3 Columbia theaters. An average of about 30 shows per week are now presented from these auditorium studios. But much work is required before the average theater can be used for broadcasting purposes. When the Columbia engineers consulted us on the job of getting this theater ready for broadcasting, the first problem was to keep out noise. 3 chief noise sources had to be fought. An elevated railroad runs alongside the theater. Directly underneath us, a subway train roars by every 2 minutes or so, and right behind the theater, the vibration from the heavy machinery of a powerhouse substation could be heard clearly. To help show what these noises were like, here is a sample of the elevated noise and other miscellaneous street noises, just as these sounded in the theater before work was begun. I imagine that everybody recognized in that sample some familiar noises of New York City. The automobiles, the streetcars at a nearby crossing, and the rest. If we had time for a longer sample, you would have heard the elevated railway trains as they passed outside, only about 15 feet from one wall of the theater. Tests showed us that nearly all this street and elevated noise entered the theater through the air. To keep it out, we closed every crack around the doors and windows on that side of the theater and made them noise-proof. But this did not keep out the subway noise. Here is what that noise sounded like. You heard that as a kind of deep-toned rumble. Really, it was a building vibration, shaking the foundations and walls as a train passed through the tube almost directly underneath the theater. To keep out this subway noise, we did 2 things. One was to line all ventilating ducts and similar passages in the basement with soft rock wool to absorb noise let loose by the vibrating foundations. The second was to cut loose the stage of the theater from these foundations, as I shall describe presently. Our third noise source was the powerhouse next door, which originally sounded like this. All poetry of these noises we have been careful to reproduce tonight in exactly the same intensities they had in the theater before the work began. Noise meter measurements made beforehand are being duplicated now. To keep out that last noise, the powerhouse one, we had to separate the stage from the rear wall of the building. The engineers agreed to cut it loose from that wall as well as from the foundations. The vibration is still there in the wall, but nothing gets into the microphone here in the auditorium. And now let us hear how all three of these original noises sounded together. One chief way of keeping out noise I still have not described. This is the floating stage. The top stage on which I am standing really floats on the original theater stage underneath, like a raft floating on water. It rests on a lot of the little soundproof supporters called chairs. The stage beneath still may vibrate if it likes. The chairs keep this vibration out of the floating stage and thus keep noise out of the auditorium and the microphone. But the real proof is what you hear, or don't hear, in the radio programs. Mr. Howard Barlow and some of his musicians are kind enough to be here this evening, and I'm going to ask them to play a short selection. You will agree that that was the kind of music which would be particularly disturbed by noise, and that was played as an acoustical sample of the theater as it now is, just as broadcast programs are presented from this theater regularly. I don't think that any outside noise was audible, except perhaps a few rustlings and other small noises that always happen when a large audience is present. Perhaps you noticed, too, the relative brilliance of the orchestra's tone, and the effect it gave of being in a large room. That is a result of what is called reverberation, as I shall mention in a moment. And now, by way of contrast, I'm going to ask the orchestra to play a part of that same selection again. But this time we shall let the same noises you heard a moment ago, against which the orchestra would have had to fight in the theater had it not been noise-proofed. We will let those noises come in at the same time as the orchestra. Another noise-proofing expedient is the plaster cyclorama at the back of the stage. The back of this looks like a crazy man's idea of an alligator hide. It is covered all over with hundreds of bumps of different shapes and sizes, put on as irregularly as possible. This is to keep the cyclorama itself from vibrating. It then acts as a sound shield instead of a sound radiator. Several planned expedients were not used because we got enough noise reduction without them. One was to put vibration-proof foundations under some of the machines next door. Another was to hang sound-absorbing draperies above the stage. And now let me speak of something inside the theater, the echoing of sound or reverberation. If this reverberation is too great, programs sound as though given in an empty barn. If it is too small, programs sound dead and lifeless. Acoustical engineers test this reverberation by playing a loud musical tone in the auditorium, stopping this suddenly, and measuring the time the sound takes to die away. We can let you hear a brief sample of such a test. You first will hear a variable, warbling tone corresponding approximately to the C above middle C on the piano. This tone then will stop. Immediately you will hear, I think, the whir of the electric timer measuring in units of less than 1/100th of a second the time required for the sound to die away. Ready, Mr. Johnson? Go ahead. You heard in that the whir at the end of the tone, and the length of that whir is an indication of the time of reverberation. By such tests, conditions inside the theater may be checked. If necessary, they can be changed. Next come electric and acoustic problems of getting programs properly into the microphones, problems which I think have been admirably solved in this instance by the engineers of the Columbia Broadcasting System. As a test of some of these facilities, the workshop program plans to present tonight part of a stage play, exactly as it would be played on the stage. For example, allowing the actors to move freely from place to place. That needs some special kinds and special handling of microphones. First, I shall ask Mr. Barry to walk past an ordinary microphone while he speaks a few lines.
I am now walking past an ordinary microphone. You will notice that my voice changes in loudness as I move about. That is because the microphone is fixed in one position and does not follow my movement.
You notice the way in which the sounds grow louder and then died away by a mere change of the speaker's position in front of the microphone. That is why actors using ordinary microphones must stand in fixed positions. Among modern studio devices, there is, however, the parabolic microphone, in which a shell-like reflector about 3 feet across collects the sound like a mirror and reflects it into the microphone's electric ear. I now shall ask Mr. Barry to walk past one of these parabolic microphones.
I am now walking past a parabolic microphone, which is being held in a fixed position. You will notice the changes in loudness as I move about. This is because my voice is louder when I am directly in front of the microphone than when I am out of its range.
You will notice that there were changes of loudness with that microphone also. But we can focus this microphone to follow the speaker at a greater distance. This ability of the parabola to focus sound can be used to follow an actor across the stage acoustically, much as you follow him by sight through a pair of opera glasses. Now let us ask Mr. Barry to repeat his walk, but while we keep the parabolic microphone pointed directly at him.
I am now walking across the stage, but the parabolic microphone is focused upon me, so that I am always within its range, and my voice comes to you with equal loudness.
And now I shall turn my microphone back to Mr. Barry, who will tell you of the play in which you will hear these engineering accomplishments utilized for a departure in dramatic technique.
Thank you, Dr. Freeze. The Columbia Workshop, by arrangement with Sidney Harmon and the Actors Repertory Company, is about to present a scene from 200 Were Chosen, a play by E.P. Conkle, directed by Worthington Minor, which had its premiere performance on Broadway last night at the 48th Street Theater. The play received high critical acclaim and promises to be one of the season's outstanding dramatic hits. It is singularly appropriate that this play, dealing with an historic social experiment, should be presented in conjunction with a broadcast experiment. Ordinarily, in the broadcasting of such a play, The actors would remain fixed in their positions before the microphone, making it necessary to use several microphones for a large cast, and restricting the mood and the movement of the performers, because they cannot simulate realistic dramatic action. In tonight's experiment, three new type directional microphones will be used in such a way as to permit the actors to perform this scene exactly as they do on the stage, with complete freedom and unrestricted action. One of the three microphones will be used to focus on the performer who may be moving about on the stage, while the other two directional microphones will pick up those characters who remain fixed in their position. In ordinary dramatic broadcasting techniques, actors rarely move farther than 1 or 2 feet away from the microphone. In the scene you will hear in a moment, the performers will be not less than 15 feet away from the microphone. In May 1935, in the heart of Mantanuska Valley, Alaska, where the summer is 4 months long and the land is rich and fertile, arrived a group of 200 people, 20th century pioneers sent by the United States government to settle a new land. 200 were chosen as a realistic drama concerning itself with the difficulties and disappointments they encountered, and of the pioneering spirit which ultimately overcame their many obstacles. Among the hardships they suffered were lack of food and shelter. Illness followed, and consequently a nostalgia for home. The scene we have chosen for our demonstration, in which we find Cleve, husband of Jenny Walters, the first to lose courage. Disgusted with the disappointments he has had, he decides to leave to search for gold. He is packing his belongings.
Got that wash van, Jenny?
Yes, here it is. Thanks. Well, Cleve, you're off to the war.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Off to the gold war.
What time does the train pull out?
In about an hour. Your father would be glad to see me go, would you?
No. No, I'm not glad to see you go, Cleve.
Well, Jen, I'm terrible sorry about last night. I mean my getting drunk. I didn't know what I was doing today.
Oh, it won't be hard to forget that. You got everything? Those woolen socks?
Well, the travel's light on the grub stake.
You can always write me here, please. I'll be here for some time.
Oh, you won't be here for no time. I'm telling you. Well, they're all going to get out. Government, everybody. Bears your grandma's platter. You're going down home now, Jen. While the going's good. I'll be sending you plenty of gold dust. Then you can get them things you want, huh?
I'm not going home, please.
All right, then, don't. You want to get stubborn? I don't care. You want to rot in this valley? Go ahead and rot. There won't be a sourdough left here to bury your bones next spring. Silly, that's what it is.
Maybe. But I'm plumb fool enough to still believe in this place, Cleve. For both of us. No use planning on going back, trying to make a go of it down there again. I made up my mind before we came. Here now or nowhere for us. So it is. Here... nowhere.
Okay. Ain't no hair out of my head. Oh, I know I'm alone. Boy.
I'm all right. Just hurts after all these years. Going together through everything. Just realizing this is all.
Oh, what's the matter with you, Jim? Why, this is under the stars. And that sawdust who's going with me knows where there's rim rock and bench land that'll turn out $36 a ton. That's a fact, Jim. This ain't no wild goose chase. Nothing of the kind. On my way back, I'll pick you up at Anchorage. Let me go down and see some of them places we always wanted to see. Oh, go down to Texas. Or out to Oregon to see Jake Jordan. Why, gold, darn it, I told my old man I'd bring you back a sack of gold.
When I climb into that front porch and pull it on him, he'll fall through his chair.
Yeah. Just what Dad'll ever put about
him. You're telling me. I'll perk up, Ken. I'll send you something now and then.
That'll be fine, please.
I'll make a go of it. You'll be proud of it.
Goodbye, Cleve.
But I ain't coming back here. No, by God. I'm wiping my feet clean. You meet me down there, or... Well, I'll be seeing you down home again.
Freeze the press.
First what?
To go. The first of us to desert. I knowed it was coming, and I was just waiting to see who'd be the first.
Down the valley.
My woman back in St. Paul. I expect she's putting the youngest to bed about now.
The moon. And the wind waving the green corn and blowing through the grape arbor. I can almost see it, can't you, Luke?
Yeah.
It's such a nice home. The well was under the porch. And Luke made me a cooler box to let down into it. Everybody in town wanted my butter of a Saturday.
Dad had a nice barn, too. It had cement floors.
I reckon I had the best patch alfalfa in that half of the state. Till we lost it all.
Nothing finer than field grown.
Me and Tom used to go out and plow together. Till the boys came. It was always cool and fresh before the sun came up. We worked so hard.
We thought it was honor.
I guess we ain't none of us here because we never worked.
Of course, that was all a long time ago. I'll just go have a look at the baby, Daddy.
Remember that box supper over at the Goose Creek schoolhouse that night?
Yeah. By golly, yeah. I'll bet you won't forget it never.
There's the Goshen Ice Age. They was the meanest, ornery bunch of human critters ever got together in one schoolhouse.
What happened, Spray?
Well, I was courting Nanny Taylor then. Nanny was a super religious gal, couldn't tolerate no one cussing her. I was running out the backyard every few minutes to fetch her a drink of water, cause she was so thirsty, and I kind of liked her so much, so...
So?
You know what them hide-bound, hamstrung, gall-provoking hunyaks done?
Oh, no, what?
Well, he was all out there in the backyard talking, including Tom, mostly, and they decided they'd move that well curb a few feet to the south.
Uh-oh.
Well... Here I come now, cutting a swath high, wide, and handsome for the well curb. Well, I hit her. Down I went.
Yeah, was like a snuck dog.
He liked to lay the barber pole right there.
They drug me out, sopping wet and hopping mad, and making the air black and blue with howling. I ain't a swearing man, I says, and I ain't gonna swear, but I'll lick the blankety blank, 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 blank that moved that well curb.
No!
And all that, your goddamn heads off. But I lost my little Nanny Taylor's account of that. Here I am. Still single. Well, land to go to. So's Nanny.
God, that was the big time. Everybody chipped in. Crib full of corn. Plenty to eat, plenty to do. Two cars in the barn.
Let's go home before something else happens. Luke, let's go home. Harley, come here a second.
Huh?
Take a look at the baby, will you? What's the matter? Can I help you?
Well, I don't know. I think he's running a fever.
Oh.
Fever?
You may not know it, Tom, but those kids can't stand that diet of fresh meat and fish much longer. You ain't getting the right kind of grub, nor enough of it.
My woman keeled over twice today.
Tom, he's real sick. You hear me?
Yes, ma'am. I hear you.
Well, do something. Don't just stand there. Do something.
Well, I'll just go see if I can find that doctor.
Thank you. Be good.
And only stop that singing.
I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
Oh, Mother, please don't cry.
I thought she was the big leader, Tom. What's the matter? Got the clamp in the old galookas?
Give me a chance to think.
When you think, what's good thinking now?
We gotta do something. We're tired of this.
We got it.
Yeah?
Maybe we will.
Yeah, what?
Start singing, you fellas.
Huh? What for? There's women in these tents. We don't want them to hear us. Now, come on, start singing.
Go on, sing.
Now, look, Eli. They got in a trainload of grub down there at the commissary today. And us fellows can't let it spoil, can we?
What can we do about it, Tom?
Thought I told you to sing, Luke. We can go down there and get some of it, can't we?
Well, I don't know, Tom.
You don't know? Say, you've been bellyaching about not getting enough food. How your children are coming down and your women faint. Why, our kids have got to have vegetables and fruit. Salt. That's by God, salt. Common salt. You men know what they got in down there today? They've got in oranges, grapes, apples, potatoes, and cabbages, and carrots, and baked beans. But what do you men say?
I reckon I'll go in.
Shh.
Any others? They got it guarded, Tom. Why, sure they have. What a week.
I've been wanting to go down there and one of those fellows.
Say, now, listen, you hold on there. My God, we're not going out to hurt anyone. We're out to get food for our kids. That's all, but if anyone gets in the way, there'll be trouble and plenty of them.
That'll be red, Tom. It's hard for anybody with the tent to yell and detain you.
Now, look here, Nickel,
sit down, Luke. You fellas can call it red or yellow, whatever color you want to call it. But I ain't going to sit here and starve while there's grub down there. If I have to go down alone, I'm going with a club in my hand big enough to brain any man that tries to stop me.
You won't have to go alone, Tom.
No.
Good. All right, now listen. Now, looky here. It'll take us about 3 hours to round up them other camps. Better say we'll meet here about 12:30. Now, Herb, go over to camp 4 and 5 and round up all the men you can.
Yeah.
Get them here in a hurry.
Sure. You see if there's any construction boys like yourself. Bring along with us.
Get them off, Tom.
Luke, you and Mickey come along with me. We take a trip down along the track.
The raid doesn't take place, and food, medicine, and homes are finally achieved. 200 were chosen as the story of the struggles of a group of American pioneers who uprooted their homes in the Middle West and built a flourishing community in a new land. The Columbia Workshop dedicated tonight's program to the scientists, research workers, and engineers of the electrical industry, and especially to the members of the New York Electrical Society here in the theater with us. Dr. E.E. Freed demonstrated how the Columbia Radio Theater was adapted for broadcasting purposes, and an experiment in microphone pickup was shown with the assistance of the Actors Repertory Company and Sidney Horman, who presented a scene from their new play, 200 Were Chosen. Instead of the ordinary microphones, which are placed in a fixed position and require close grouping by the actors, special microphones were used, permitting the actors to move about freely, disregarding the microphone entirely, and playing the scene exactly as they do on the stage. The parabolic microphone, swinging freely on its axis, picked up their voices with equal intensity from every part of the stage, operating on the principle of a flexible motion picture camera.
We wish to thank our listeners for the many letters we received commenting upon last week's broadcast of Hamlet. There were more letters about this broadcast than were ever received before by the workshop. We are planning to present more of these radio dramatizations of Shakespeare's plays. Tune in next week for another Columbia Workshop presentation. The Columbia Workshop is under the direction of Irving Reese. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.